Hello, my name is Hayden Thompson and welcome to the Pack Heavy Podcast. Now, this show is really for anyone in the hospitality and food manufacturing industries that uses flexible packaging to get their products to market. Here, I'll be talking about everything food packaging and providing you with the information and knowledge that you need to get the right food package into your hands and into the hands of your consumer. I'm really excited to be interviewing guests just like you who have traveled the path that you're on so that you can learn from their successes and failures and engage in the mindset required to go all in on your vision. Now, I personally call this mindset the pack heavy mentality, and it is driven by deliberate actions such as making the decision to go all in on your vision for your business. So I'm talking about gathering market intelligence, putting a strong plan in place, organizing the appropriate resources, and then executing on your strategy with precision. So if you're packing heavy on your vision, you're definitely in the right place, and I'm really excited to have you here. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode number 12 of the Pack Heavy Podcast. On today's show, I'm excited to have Neil Thompson, founder and CEO of Laidback Snacks, along with me today. Laidback Snacks, formerly known as Naked Snacks, is a business located here in Richmond, BC that Neil, along with his wife Riley, created in 2014. Famous for its deliciously healthy snacks, Laidback can be found in more than 175 vendors across the country, including Whole Foods, Urban Fare, and many Fairmont hotels and resorts. Neil has a BCom in business, along with prior experience in the tech industry in the UK, prior to moving to Canada in 2008 and completed his MBA up at UBC. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Thanks for having me, Hayden. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks, mate. I know you're a busy man. You've got your beautiful newborn child at 3 months, and we were just having a discussion prior to kicking off here that you're only burning the oil on 4 hours sleep.
Yeah, it's definitely new. As a firstborn, I feel like all my friends said to me, the kid's going to arrive. Make sure you get all your sleep in. Make sure you enjoy your freedom on weekends. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I understand what you mean. And now that it's here and I'm 3 months in, I wish I'd listened a little more closely to those friends.
That resonates with me, mate. I'm quite envious of my buddies that don't have children at the moment because, yeah, like you're a business owner, you know just how much time and effort and energy goes into it. And then, obviously the balance of work life gets skewed in one direction when you've got a newborn at home. And how have you managed to sort of, well, let's start here. Being a new father and obviously running an operation like Laidback Snacks, how have you sort of managed to afford yourself the opportunity to get some time at home?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think because of COVID, there's a more natural reason for me to hang around at home. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, that makes it a little easier. At the moment, we have a team that's in the office working together on Mondays and Fridays.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, we kind of have a voluntary day, but otherwise the world as we know it has gone hugely remote. And so the team works remotely Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think when we come back to it and hopefully the world's been vaccinated and herd immunity is the thing that we talk about every day. I think on our optimal sort of time in the office probably looks like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We work really nicely as a remote team. And it's a different case for the actual production team. So we kind of split between an office team and the office team has the benefit of being able to sit behind computers and be flexible. And then the production team is in making all of our delicious snacks and working their butts off every day. And it's a different dynamic. We're incredibly grateful to them. But for the office team and for me, I try and make sure I'm in the facility certainly at least once every week. And then just depending on my team, you know, in this world that we live in with virtual tools and Zoom and Slack and everything, we can communicate effectively and clearly. And I feel like I can be more efficient with my time. Obviously with the little kid, as you know, sometimes I have a window where I'm free between 7:30 and 9 and I can do my work then. And sometimes I have a window in the morning between 10 and 11 where it's absolute chaos and I have to actually down tools and go and help with the kid. So I think it's just this beautiful world we live in where we have these tools that can allow us to be more efficient with our time. And I'm lucky enough to be able to move things around and reschedule.
It sounds to me like, obviously those personal relationships at work and also maintaining a relationship with Riley means everything to you, you know?
Yeah.
And so managing your time is, you know, is a really tough thing for all entrepreneurs. You just mentioned Slack. How do you structure your day at the moment? Do you leave some flexibility in there? Or do you sort of have, like you were just saying, you've got sort of set days where you're going in, but sort of how flexible is that even?
I think for me, it starts with realizing when I work really well. And I have some folks on my team who are phenomenally productive between the hours of 8 p.m. and 2 a.m. in the morning. And I look at them and I think, that's insane. By that point in the day, my brain is just dead. But for these folks, it's a fantastic time for them to get stuff done and be amazing. For me, I definitely am better first thing in the morning. When the brain is fresh. So I look to get started in my day. I try not to schedule calls unless they're really important and can't be moved for any time before 11 a.m. And when I sit down at my desk, I typically turn off anything that'll send a notification to me. Mm. So emails go off, Slack gets minimized, phone gets turned over, and I use the time between normally sort of 6 to 11, and in that there's going to be some bottle feeding and mm-hmm. and butt cleaning of the baby, and I make sure that that's the time of the day when, you know, it works for me to in particular to be doing things that are deep tasks. If I need to work on our financial model or put together a presentation or write up a proposal, that's when I'll do it. And then typically in the afternoons, I'll have some lunch. And then in the afternoons between 2 and 5 or 6, that's when I'll schedule calls and meetings and things like that. So for me, the foundation of it all is just figuring out when I work really nicely and then protecting that time. Mm. And boy, it's not easy to do, but it's so important to do it.
It is. And, you know, what I've found is being really strict and diligent with your time comes with experience. And I guess you're at a point in your career where you've sort of learnt to understand when you are most effective at work and, you know, what time of the day and so on. How did you sort of arrive at that place? Like, did you work through your 20s and sort of found that you were stretched and that you sort of bit off more than you can chew? Sort of take us back to when you were in London working in the tech space and how that sort of impacted sort of where you've arrived at today.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, because in your 20s, it feels like 20s are just this experimental time for most people, when which we're figuring out what works for us and what doesn't. And I definitely suffered from a massive lack of awareness in my 20s. I was just doing stuff, and the expression throwing stuff against the wall, that's absolutely what I was just doing. The nature of the tech world back then, I was working in consulting for retail banks and investment banks, and just being young and ambitious and thinking that that is going to be the fulfilling path for me. And certainly it's a really competitive environment. I think I felt when I was in my 20s, I had a lot to prove. I wanted to see what I could do. And the way that Accenture in particular structures things is every 6 months, everyone who's been working gets graded by their management team in terms of performance. And then that grading gets passed on to a sort of regional pool so that everyone gets, they call it laddering. Everyone gets laddered against each other. And then it goes to a national level and everyone gets laddered against each other. And then things like salary changes and title changes, promotions, they all depend on the laddering process. So everyone is just going crazy to be as competitive as possible and do a great job. So there's not a lot of time for awareness. It definitely took me moving to BC, and the MBA period was an awesome time for me because, and it felt like such a helpful and productive break at that point in my career. At the late 20s, I feel like I've experienced a ton of things. I digested a lot of information. And then I got to UBC, moved to Vancouver in 2008. Had my 30th birthday within a month of arriving in Vancouver, got stuck into my studies, and spent a lot of time looking around, a lot of time reading. And that whole experience for me was not only what do I want to work in and actually do with my career next, but also how do I work? So it was wonderful to have the benefit of my 20s to look back on and go, oh yeah, that worked well. And like, oh yeah, that was a disaster. You did terrible work then and you didn't show up at all. Hmm. So it was great to process those and then come out the back end. And I think we benefit from so many wonderful podcasts out there. I think of people like Tim Ferriss, for example, and the knowledge and the wisdom that he shares. And I've done a lot of reading about meditation and awareness and journaling and the power of all those activities. So I'm at a point now, early 40s, definitely structure those activities into my day, which I know are going to help me with productivity. They can help me with mental health. And ultimately be better at work and be better in my personal life.
Mate, it's amazing. You and I have got a very similar story in that I feel as if we've both got clearly defined chapters of our lives, and it's probably just due to the moving of between countries and so on. I also completed my master's as a mature age student as well, and I found that to be so beneficial, just having all of the experience of you know, full-time work under my belt to draw from, and approaching the study with, you know, a really well, I mean, it was quite strategic as to what I wanted to study. I did my master's in entrepreneurship and innovation, which is very similar to an MBA in a lot of ways. And but going into that and obviously paying for it out of my own pocket, and you know, there were so many different things that that allowed me to be a much better student than what I was when I was in my early 20s or, you know, in my late teens. So
when did you, Hayden, when did you decide you wanted to do a podcast?
Oh, this is only really recent. So yeah, let me give you a bit of insight there. So in March last year, I was actually, prior to working here at Foodpak, my last position was at Salt Spring Coffee, and I was the food service sales manager there. And when COVID hit in March, my sales dried up to $0 basically within a week. Like all of the food service businesses, cafes, restaurants, you name it, all of the large institutional purchases like UBC, Grouse Mountain and the Vancouver Aquarium, that those businesses just closed their doors overnight. So it just made sense for Salt Spring Coffee to temporarily lay me off. But that temporary layoff period eventually turned into a permanent layoff. And that in itself was a bit of a shock because, you know, having a young family and so on. But it really allowed me, and I sort of spoke to this prior on another episode, but it sort of allowed me to sort of figure out the direction that Ash, my wife, and I wanted to take the family and what I really wanted in my career. So it was, once again, another really defined chapter. And I had 5.5 months off before I found this position and started on the 1st of September at Foodpak. Mm-hmm. And it's the best thing I ever did. It's all worked out so well, and I've never been happier in my career. And you know, one of the things that I really wanted to embark on was a way to sort of get out there and build a bit of a reputation for myself as a salesperson. And one of the ways of doing that I found was to start a podcast and have really interesting conversations with people like yourself, just to learn about the industry and also get out there and do something useful with my time. And see if I could build something again. Yeah, so
it sounds like a great natural extension.
Yeah, it does. It works really well. And you know, I think that it's becoming more and more popular where salespeople are getting out there and starting podcasts, and I'm having conversations with business owners like yourself. And I'm then obviously out there talking to other business owners that the conversations that we have are impactful, and you know, they learn a lot from. And so, yeah, it's going hand in hand with both my position at Foodpak and sort of the direction that I want to take my life as well. So it felt quite a natural fit.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's very good. Cool. It's interesting, like just thinking about your past and those clearly defined chapters and sort of where you are right now, especially coming from a different industry like tech and into the health food space that you're in right now, like they're quite different industries. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but think of that Steve Jobs quote, you know, where he stated, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. So what's been your approach when looking forward into life?
Wow. It mostly the lens I look through is learning. Mm. I've always prioritized learning, and I've definitely been in jobs where I've sat there and I felt like, okay, I know how this fits together. I know all the pieces of the puzzle. What now? Mm. And I sat in that space for a couple of months, and I found that by the end of 6 months in that space where I don't feel like I'm learning anything new, I've just got really itchy feet to get out there and do something else. And I think that just comes from a natural kind of curiosity. And with this company really came from a love of entrepreneurship. Mm. And during my time at UBC, seeing a lot of entrepreneurs and working in a consulting basis with a couple of companies and seeing what they were achieving, seeing how they were making sense of clearly, or not clearly, but making sense of undefined spaces and bringing clarity to those opportunities. And I thought, you know, I really would love to have that experience. I want to figure out what that looks like. And as you alluded to, jumping into food and having no background in food, looking back is just a mad thing to do because there's so much, about the industry and so much I had to learn, and that learning curve is just so steep. The other thing that's wonderful about moving into an industry and not knowing everything is that our brains are certainly predisposed to taking shortcuts, in that we often don't want to learn things firsthand. We want to hear other people tell us the answers, and then we internalize that, and then we move on more quickly and we conserve energy. Throughout that process of having to learn things firsthand, I did find myself asking a lot of questions like, why does the food industry do it this way? Why are people making these decisions? And within that process, there are definitely some nuggets and moments where fresh eyes come to an industry and an opportunity. And there were tons of blunders and things where I questioned things and I was like, it's always been done like that for a reason, dummy. And that makes a lot of sense too. There's certainly a couple of nuggets there. And I think specifically of our approach as being a digital first tech company in the food space, which is certainly not something that's commonly found. There's such well-defined distribution channels through grocery and through other retail and food services you mentioned, that to build a dedicated online snacking experience and then all of the marketing and all the dynamics that surround that and growing that business, especially in a time when most people and most food companies, I think when they think of selling online, they just plop something on Amazon and they say, yeah, we sell online. Great. And we've definitely gone tech first. And so I attribute that to my background in tech consulting and being able to kind of bring that lens to a space and say, okay, well, let's look for some new opportunities and let's figure out how we can do things slightly differently. I'm certain that the company has benefited from that.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. On last week's episode, I had Rick Zabojski from Dover on, and I know you distribute through Rick. So yeah, we had a really good chat, and it was awesome to sort of get a little bit more insight into the sort of CPG distribution sort of world, because it is a whole different world out there, isn't it? And then so when you were looking at distribution channels and way to get out to market, obviously you led with tech. When you first got started, how has the business model evolved from sort of its inception to where it is now through that space?
Yeah, it is an interesting one, because we certainly started off and I said, we're an e-commerce company and that's what we're going to do. Mm. And we are, people throw around the word disruptive pretty loosely. Mm-hmm. But in our own internal definition of that, we thought we're going to be disruptive. We're going to do tech first and we're going to be just e-commerce and we're not going to do anything else. And it was wonderful because I felt like I was applying the experience and the knowledge that I had from my career and I could bring that to the fore. It was limiting in that over time, we realized there were a lot of folks saying to us, we would like to buy your snacks and sell your products, but we don't want to order online. Mm. And it was this real sort of push-pull, and I guess there was a little bit of tension there where for a long time, we did just say, nope, we got to stick to our strategy. We got to stay focused. So many startups find their end because they don't stay focused. And after a while, we just realized, okay, we're gonna open this up a little bit. And actually, the first channel that we started selling into was hotels. Mm. We had a hotel in town, the Fairmont Pacific Rim, and they contacted us and they said, we'd love to sell your snacks through our minibar. And I remember saying, what have you got in your minibar at the moment? And they said, oh, we've got Pringles and Snickers. And I thought to myself, wow, you're a five-star hotel and you're selling 7-Eleven snacks.
Yep.
There could be something here. And so I had a conversation with them. That went really well. And I thought, well, let's see how we can learn from this and roll it out. Let's see what the opportunity is. And started contacting 4- and 5-star hotels within Vancouver and then within BC. And then I moved to Alberta and then I went east across the country. And by the time I'd finished that, we were in more than 55 4- and 5-star hotels. And it worked out to be a really great channel for us and a really great opportunity. And that moved us from being an e-commerce only business to doing some what we call offline distribution. And then it became, I think, just a natural kind of evolution. We thought, well, what other opportunities are out there? We do need to get over this story that we have in our brains about being a tech only company, because you know there's a lot that we're missing out on if we think that way. And it was my wife Riley who said, I think we should be in grocery. I'm gonna try and get us into grocery. And off she went, and she's a phenomenal salesperson. She is one of these people, and you know, working in sales, you often meet salespeople who have this incredible ability to build rapport or establish rapport with someone within mere seconds. And Riley certainly has that in spades, and she got us going with some early grocery customers. And then we met Rick from Dover and had a conversation and got working with him. And now we've brought on a small sales team, and we're talking about opening up distribution across the rest of Canada. So it's an exciting time. It's an exciting time, and we still stay pretty true to our e-commerce roots. I think 50% of our business or so is e-commerce, especially now during COVID. Everyone's just at home sitting on their couches, mostly if they're doing what I'm doing, eating delicious snacks. So our e-commerce business dipped a little bit pre-COVID, and it's actually increased by about 3.5-4 times since COVID kicked in.
That's incredible. It's not very often that you see those kind of that kind of growth, you know, in a specific channel. What are the major hurdles that you had to get over with the e-commerce side of the business? One conversation that I have in particular with a lot of people that are tending to sell online is the cost of shipping, and that margins are so slim in this world that we're talking about. How have you sort of managed to navigate that space?
Yeah, a lot of mistakes, Hayden. It is an expensive space. It's expensive from the shipping standpoint. It's also expensive from getting eyeballs on digital marketing. That is an expensive thing to do in an increasingly crowded space with more and more people funneling money into Facebook ads and Google ads and things like that. So that was certainly a challenge to make sense of all of that. And when we started, let me tell you, we were not profitable at all, not even close to being profitable. And we spent an awful lot of time working on our unit economics. And with shipping, it's all about building scale. And the more customers we have, the more we can go to Canada Post and say, hey, we're going to need a better deal from you. And they've been fantastic partners for us, and they've really supported us in our journey. And then in the digital marketing side, and I guess the third component is really building out the website and the development and the user experience. Just through time, having a constant mindset of sort of interrogating our assumptions and figuring out, okay, we think this is working for us. Is it actually working? Like, how do we measure whether or not it's working? How do we measure objectively whether or not our website is doing what our customers want it to do? And so I did things like I answered the customer service line for the best part of 4 or 5 years, because I wanted to know what people were complaining about. And when they called up and they said, I want to be able to do this on your site, and I want to be able to do this, and this is taking too long, and this doesn't taste as good as that. All of those things were really useful data points. And it was super helpful for me to be able to stay close to those conversations and then work that back into the business. It's fantastic that I'm not answering customer service calls anymore. It frees me up to do a lot of other things. But I think it's really important to stay close to our customers, keep those feedback loops nice and tight, and realize that, you know, as we grow the business, I spend a lot of time looking at competitors and thinking, oh, competitors are doing this, so maybe we should be doing that. And gradually over the first year or two, I realized, what are our customers telling us to do? And let's listen to what they want and pay far less attention to our competitors. And I spend very little time thinking about our competitors these days.
That's such critical advice. I've heard that from a few people that are in your shoes, you know, and getting too caught up in what the competitor is doing, it just isn't constructive, is it? When you mentioned before Tim Ferriss and his podcast, I'm a huge fan of Tim's as well. He talks a lot about A-B split testing. Have you been doing any split testing on your website at all with your landing pages, or have you sort of leveraged your ability to capture information in that way?
We've done very little, to be honest, Hayden. There's definitely a volume of traffic that's required to successfully define and execute on a decent A/B test.
Okay.
And I think for us as a small company, pre-COVID, we were certainly too small to get any meaningful resolution out of it. Mm-hmm. Now we certainly can, and we definitely intend to do that in the next short while. We've just rebranded on the 26th of January. We rebranded from Naked Snacks to Layback Snacks. We've redone our site, and we've got a couple of big features within the site that we will be rolling out between now and June. And then exactly to that point, A/B testing is crucial, because, you know, we think things look great. We think people enjoy the interaction and what we're offering them online. And we think that we're getting good results and converting people in an efficient way. But absolutely, those A/B tests is just the most objective way for us to put everything, all our preferences and suppositions aside, and figure out whether things are going. So I think we're gonna get started that on the second half of this year. Mm. And that kind of makes me feel like we're a bit of a big boy company, because I feel like big boy companies do things like A/B testing.
You've grown. Yeah, exactly. Testing all of those assumptions. Yeah. The initial business model. So we've just talked about the, you know, obviously leading with a sort of tech first mentality. You've gone to market in that space, and you said it took a while for you to become profitable. I read that you did some crowdsource funding. Was that true?
Yeah, we did a Kickstarter campaign.
Kickstarter, yeah. I wasn't sure what platform you used. It was Kickstarter. Tell us about that. How did that work for you?
Yeah, that was in 2016, maybe 2015. Mm-hmm. It was a fascinating experience. It was at a time, the timing was right for us.
Yep.
We had spent a lot of time figuring out what we were offering to our customers and what our value proposition was.
Yeah.
And we thought, right, now we're going to use Kickstarter to give an injection of money. Of course, that's amazing. But also importantly, and I think even more importantly, extra publicity. We want as many people as possible to know that we exist, and in a cost-effective way, let's get going on this. And so we got going. It was a really fun process, because it's fun figuring out, okay, how are we going to structure this campaign? It's essentially just a marketing campaign. What story are we going to tell? Mm-hmm. We got to put together a video. How are we going to market to people? Which channels are we going to push things out on? What messaging are we going to use? And a little bit nerve-wracking, to be honest. I remember getting started and thinking, you know, holy smokes, you set up this this target to be reached, and if you don't reach it, you don't get anything at all. Mm. And we got cracking, and luckily we had a really good response, in particular from the community that we had around us at the time. And it's something that I believe so strongly in for almost every business, is the ability to build a community and have a community of people, however it's defined, really root for the business and pull for the business and want the business to succeed. I'm not sure that companies can really succeed, and certainly startup companies, which are like these fragile little creatures, can succeed without that community sort of willing it on. And I think our success with Kickstarter was definitely the strength of that community. And it looks like friends and colleagues and family and friends of friends and early adopters who we know absolutely just love what we do. And then really nurturing, building, respecting and recognizing that community. And we came out of Kickstarter and we've done really nicely. We had a lot more people who knew about us. We certainly had some great publicity and some media. And we went straight from there into an incubator in Vancouver to then say, okay, this is the natural next step for us. Let's figure out where to next. How do we keep growing?
Mm. Was it at that incubator that you met some connections that you're still working with today? Or was that sort of like an isolated event?
The incubator was fantastic. I mean, it's a whole network of people. Mm. And it's a network beyond just the other companies that are in the incubator. It's also the folks who run it. And virtually on a weekly basis, we had different speakers coming in and chatting to us about the work that they do. And I mean, much like the MBA program for me, it was really, I want to meet as many people as possible. Mm. I want to have as many conversations as possible. I want to figure out what opportunities there might be. And today, I think of someone like a chap named Keith Ipple, who runs an incubator called Spring.
Keith Ipple.
Yeah, they work out of UBC. Mm-hmm. And Keith is a phenomenal chap. And he came in and he presented to us one morning. And I'm not sure if you've had moments when you see someone speak and you just think, that guy knows what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Keith's got it together. And since then, working with Keith, you know, we're six years after meeting Keith, still have frequent contact with him. He has young entrepreneurs coming up through his own incubator, and he'll ask me to mentor and have conversations with them. I've gone to him on a number of occasions with all sorts of things, and I've said, Keith, I need to pick your brain about these things. Or Keith, we're looking to do a round of funding. Can you help us, introduce us to some investors, things like that? So Keith certainly springs to mind. And the other chap is a chap named Donovan Woolard, who now runs a technology company in town called Open Technologies. And at the time, he was actually running the incubator. And fantastic guy. He's the first chap who ever cut us a check. When we got into the incubator, he said, I think you guys are on to something good here. And I still have frequent contact with him. We're in a clean technology investment club together. Mm-hmm. He's a good guy. So there's so many good things that come out of these relationships. And true to life, they're relationships and dynamics that are going to be bigger than just the company that we're working on at any one point in time.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, it sounds like to me, the success of most business is really hinged on the relationships and the people that you're surrounded by. And I was really excited to hear just then that you're also doing some mentoring as well. So tell me a little bit more about that. Like, mentoring is a give and take sort of, you know, space in that you're giving of your time, but you're also getting a lot out of it as well. What do you get out of mentoring?
I think for me, it's definitely just a chance to give back. Mm. And I think of our journey getting started. And the first place that we went to for any sort of financial support was a government organization called Futurepreneur. Mm-hmm. And Futurepreneur kind of says, sure, we will give you a loan, but that loan comes with strings. And there's this mentor that you're going to have to work with on a monthly basis and give us dedicated number of hours, and he's going to help you with your business. And I remember at the time thinking, it would be nice to just get the check. I'm not sure that I really need the mentor. And I got paired up with a chap named David Van Cedars, who started Spud. And David and I sat down, and David, I remember him looking at my financial model in the beginning, and he just shook his head and he said, nope. And I said, well, what do you mean no? And he said, this is wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that needs to change. You're counting this twice. And we went through this process, and that's the beauty of having someone with so much experience in the food industry and looking at my model and unpicking that. There are definitely moments when someone with deep industry expertise is just perfect. So he complimented what I was bringing. And we spent the best part of a year kind of every month unpacking and pulling apart that model, to the point where I thought I would throw things against the wall at some point because I just couldn't get it the way he wanted to. And eventually now it's in this place, which just gives us so much certainty and brings so much confidence to me in that I know exactly what's happening with my business. I can run different scenarios against the model and see exactly how things are affected and what decisions need to be made. So I look back at that experience with David with a huge amount of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I know how wonderful I feel about having that help. And I think it's beholden to me certainly to pass that on.
I've got two more questions for you. I know you wanted to sort of keep this under the hour. So I've got two more questions that I think we could finish up with. The first one being about the transition into Laid Back Snacks. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's been an interesting journey and amazingly one that's taken the best part of sort of 2 years.
Yeah.
We started off with Naked Snacks, and Naked Snacks was great because naked is not a controversial word, but it's certainly a word that captures attention. and we loved it, and the brand was working really well. And one of our investors said, "Hey, why, if it's working, don't change it. You don't mess with it." So it wasn't a decision that we came by easily. The limitation of Naked is it does a great job of talking about the product we sell, but it doesn't really speak to why we're in business and why we do what we do. And so I went out there probably in 2018 to find a name that would be more representative of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And the second part of that was I want to find something that I can trademark and something that we can own and is just ours. And I can't even tell you, Hayden, how few unique names there are out there within each category, certainly within the natural food space, that meet both those criteria, are a great fit for the company, they answer the why well, and they also are trademarkable. So Laid Back Snacks is fantastic because it's a name that we can trademark in both regions. And it also speaks about so much more than the product. We create these delicious products. We want to make sure that people feel great about choosing Laid Back Snacks for their snacking needs. And we want to make sure they feel great about choosing us as a company. Mm. It's certainly, we're in a world, particularly with younger consumers, where they're not just buying products and services based on the product and service itself as a standalone entity. They want to know why they should support that company. And so we show up with a vision that says we're creating a more relaxed world, one snack at a time. And that is really then embodied in the beautiful snacks that we put out. It's embodied in the variety that we put out for our customers. It's embodied in our 80-20 nutritional philosophy. So we make sure that it's wholesome and delicious at the same time. And then we also have a giving back component. We want to make sure that within the stakeholder community we operate within, that we are doing more than just making a profit. So we're supporting our community. For every box that folks buy online from us, we donate a snack to Breakfast Club of Canada. And we know that that's a cause. It's a wonderful charity, and they work all across the country feeding kids, mostly in vulnerable populations. It's a food security issue that isn't spoken about a lot. It seems a bit crazy in 2021 that there's still kids who go to school and they don't get to have a breakfast. So we're excited to help with that. It matters a lot to us. We know it matters to our customers, and it's a wonderful alignment.
Fantastic.
So the journey from Naked to Laid was 2 years in the making. And then our strategy really for launching was, okay, you know, we had that investor who said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And we recognized that a lot of the personality, a lot of the look and the feel of Naked is just great. So let's keep with the same packaging. Let's keep our bags very similar. We're gonna refresh them. There you go.
Awesome. Yeah, got one here. Yeah.
Food Pack makes them for us. Beautiful. Yeah. We love them. And freshen them up, give them a pop of color, but then still stay kind of true to the brand personality.
Yeah. And yeah, absolutely have. I think you guys nailed it. We were all sitting around the boardroom looking at your packaging the other day, and everybody was really impressed, not only just by the quality of the bag, but the cleanliness of your design. it's so recognizable out there on the shelf. It stands out, and you can pick it a mile away as you're walking up to the shelf. Like, you can see it before you see anything else, just because of that recognizable white, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That's great to hear. Thanks, Hayden. Because that's one of the first kind of anxieties you're thinking.
Oh, yeah.
And just like starting a company, when you, the proof is in the pudding. Once you put it out in the world and consumers see it, what's that gut reaction? You know, we buy on emotion. And to hear you say that you see it on the shelf and it jumps out, that means the world. That's awesome to hear.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I know that when I'm walking up and down the grocery aisle shelf, because I work in the world of packaging, I take note of these things, especially now more so than ever in my life. And if I'm looking for something in particular, like, it's really nice to be able to find it straight away. And there are some jars out there that are like every other jar of, you know, peanut butter or whatever. But when you come across a brand that's really recognizable, you know that that's not, it's completely intentional, you know, that somebody's put a lot of time and energy into it. No worries. My second question for you, if you were starting all over again from scratch, or you were speaking to somebody who had an idea of starting a business and moving into the retail space, where would you tell them to spend 90% of their time and energy?
Specifically if they're moving into the retail space?
Or no, any business. If you were like, you're starting a business, I would spend all of my upfront time and energy working on this. What would that this be?
Building relationships. And it's a mistake that I made. I started off thinking that I kind of had a point to prove and that the company would succeed or not based on how capable I was and how hard I worked. And I didn't enroll people in the journey as much as I could have.
Yeah.
And I think it took me until sort of 2016 before I was holding on with clenched fists, and I was like, this is my baby and I must make it succeed and you must grow. And in 2016, I kind of opened up my hands and I just said, hey, I need help. I need help wherever I can get it. I need help from everyone, and everyone is welcome to join me on this journey. The only way it's going to succeed and the only way that we're going to do great things is if this is a shared journey. And we all pull together, we all feel great about it, we all celebrate the success together. And obviously the downside is feel the failures that inevitably come along.
Yeah.
But it's definitely those relationships, building those relationships, and just constantly sharing and inviting people into this journey that you're on.
Awesome. Mate, that was awesome. That was such a, there were so many nuggets of gold in amongst this conversation. I genuinely appreciate it. I'm looking forward to going back through the podcast and digging into it again, because there was just so much learning. And honestly, mate, the amount of value that you've just brought everybody that's tuned in has been huge. So thank you so much for your time, and just give everybody a little bit of insight as to how they can find your product, where they have to go, and any last parting words on your behalf, mate.
Yeah, thanks, Hayden. It was wonderful to be here. So thank you for inviting me. That's it's been wonderful. It's always interesting to kind of have thoughts that are noodling around in my brain. And then it's not until someone invites you on a podcast that you can kind of open up your brain and they come out your mouth. So this has been a wonderful opportunity.
No worries.
For folks who are interested in our product, we would love you to visit us at laidbacksnacks.com. We have 31 different snacks for everyone to choose from. We have snacks that are dietary specific, so feel free to filter according to gluten-free, nut-free, vegan, etc. We ship throughout North America, coast to coast, and we would love to connect with you on social as well. So find us on Instagram and Facebook, and we'd love you to join us on our journey and be a part of our community.
That's great, mate. Thank you so much. I'll let you get back to Riley and Bubs.
Thanks, Hayden. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions from today's episode or would like to know more about what I can do to help you achieve your packaging vision, you can reach me directly at hayden@thepackheavypodcast.com. You could DM me on Instagram @thepackheavypodcast, or we could also connect on LinkedIn and start a conversation there. I'll see you next week.